Hello, and welcome to the ABC's Green Politics, a podcast which is part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. I'm Linda Sullivan, and I'll be your host for this episode, which is actually a two-parter. I've just come on board as a co-host of this podcast, so you'll bear with me, I hope, as I find my feet and learn the podcast name. If you've just stumbled across this episode, you may well guess from the title that we're working our way down the alphabet with all things green and political with a small p, and that we've arrived at O. So O is for optimism, something that could be a bit controversial and definitely more scarce as we free fall deeper and deeper into the multi-crisis world of today. So is optimism still possible? Is it responsible? And how does optimism differ from hope, and in particular, active hope, a concept I'm rather fond of myself and that we'll be talking about? My two guests are two women I've met and organised with in my own activism, two inspiring figures from the Americas. I couldn't get them together due to time zone differences and busy schedules, so I first spoke to Mariana Gomez, a Colombian anti-mining activist who also works with Gaia Amazonas and will tell us a wee bit about her involvement in the recent COP15, the often forgotten one on biodiversity, the so-called Nature COP. I then had a conversation with Anne Simmons-Booker, who's the main support to Joanna Macy, the founder of the practice called Active Hope and the work that reconnects, as well as being a facilitator and teacher herself. So I've put them into two parts. All right, enough for me. Hope you enjoy. Okay, so I'd like to welcome Mariana Gomez. Mariana is a Colombian organizer involved with Gaia Amazonas and a founder of Yes to Life, No to Mining, which is a global network of communities resisting mining and working for a future beyond extractivism, is now coordinator of the network, along with myself and Nat Lowry in Australia. So thanks for joining me today, Mariana, and especially as you're joining me from the road. Yeah, it's great to have you. This episode of ABC's of Green Politics is about optimism. Maybe we can start by talking about in Colombia, like namely the new president and vice president. So, which is like the first left government Colombia has seen. So how did you feel when they won, Mariana? And how's it working out on the ground?
Hi, Linda. Thank you for this invitation and for having me. It's a joy to join you today from the road in Colombia. Well, that's a great question. It has been very close, the same as the elections in Brazil. They were very close between two very polarized options. And of course, for the work we do, we are happy with the results of both elections. And I mentioned Brazil because we work in the Amazon, and what happens in Brazil, it has a lot of implications in our work because the Amazon is one whole system. So the political situation is very similar. It has been very interesting to see, like, after 6 months of the first left-wing government in our history, as you say, to be being in power with a vice president that is Afro-Colombian, to see many changes, philosophical changes in the way the government approaches society and minorities and rights. And that has been very evident in like their proposals and in the way to approach, for example, the Colombian participation or the delegation in the COPs of climate change and biodiversity. There had been a very slow and low participative building the national position. And when this government came into power, they called to very like rapid civil society participation seminars and meetings around the country to gather perspectives, which was very interesting. And I would say that now the two main challenges I identify is that for in a country that is so polarized as ours, for the opposition to allow this government to really take forward its proposals. And I would say the second challenge is to go from great ideas to implementation. That is what our governments have always lacked in a country where there are some regions that have no governmental presence, you know, so taking these great proposals and ideas into real implementation with processes in place that enable these ideas to be successful. We are in the, like, the turning point between, like, the joy of celebrating the results and the questions forward on how to make this happen together.
Yeah, and you were talking recently about the new government's position on mining and extractivism, and you were saying, you know, talking about Francia Márquez's discourse and how it kind of like it was it could have been yourself talking, you know, or the communities resisting mining. So could you talk a bit more about that and how that has changed really the resistance against mining, and really I suppose when a country who's been so following the whole extractive economy model for so long, like how could that transition take place to beyond extractivism?
Well, actually what made Francia Márquez become a social, like a recognized social leader, was her resistance against mining in the region where she grew up in the Pacific coast. And so there's a clear opposition from her to mine extractives. And from the president, there's like very explicit will in like the, for example, the energetic transition. And it has been very openly said, the new Minister of Mines and Energy has talked a lot about the transition and the importance to transition. Of course, in the past right-wing governments, the sectors have gained a lot of power, especially the extractive sectors. And I think the new government has to be concrete on how to transition, you know, because that's where like that gap that sometimes the discourse and the action will give the opportunity to the sector and, you know, make these ideas to lose traction in society because like of the, there's, I don't know if, of course, there's a recession, economical recession all around the world, but in Colombia, it is hitting us very strongly. I think we have had the past months the highest price of the US dollar in Colombia. So the Colombian peso is very devalued. And of course, that economical uncertainty gives power to the discourse of the sectors and the extractives, industries, you know. And so I think that there's an urgency to take action and to make, as I was saying, clear roadmaps, action plans to transition. And that's like the question. I don't have the answer, but that's the question we are like holding at the moment, and it's a huge question, as I was saying, in a very polarized situation where action has to be taken soon with very knowledgeable, and that's what sometimes we lack in our countries, you know. We don't like the investment or the, you know, the technology to transition or to have data that shows or backs these proposals, and that's where the discourses of like the powerful sectors gain traction. So we hope there can be action soon and we can really explore how models that are, I think Colombia has very like strong references of cases that have been able to show how like a transition model is possible. The difficult thing is how to scale that up. So maybe that's a good starting point, you know, go to those reference cases, like the case in Cajamarca.
Yeah, could
that, yes, Life Not to Mining has worked so much.
Yeah, could you talk a wee bit about Cajamarca and how I suppose that was like your resistance there, and was really how you got into the Yes, Life Not to Mining network, and how you're one of the co-founders along with communities in Africa, and how I suppose, like, what was the importance of that global solidarity network for local resistance in Cajamarca? And also maybe the really important happening in Cajamarca, which was the popular consultation, which was replicated across the country and an inspiration for other communities across the world.
Yeah, well, it has been a long story, very inspiring. You can find the full story on our website, Life Not to Mining website. But to make a long story short, a huge gold mining corporation from South Africa came to the Tolima region around Ibagué in 2009 in a very agricultural region of the country. And people were very, like, rapid to not fall into the ideas of that the companies try, mining companies try to sell local people that they're gonna come out of poverty because of mining and all this. And they valued water and the natural resources that enable agriculture in that area. the mining open pit was to be in Cajamarca, and the tailings dam was envisioned to be in a municipality called Piedras, 100 kilometers in a straight line from Cajamarca. And they were going to transport all the toxic wastes of the mine 100 kilometers in a straight line through a mineral duct, like a huge conveyor belt, to a tailings dam in Piedras. And the people in Piedras, when the company started coming, resisted like their presence there. And in connection with like the people resisting in Cajamarca, where the open pit would be, Piedras organized the first popular consultation in the country. That is like a referendum that in our constitution that enables the civil society to participate in the decisions taken by the municipality. And so it was like this popular consultation met all the legal requirements to be legitimate. And with the support of the mayor in that moment in the municipality of Piedras, Piedras held, as I was saying, the first popular consultation against mining. And 98% of the voters voted no to mining. So it's a very interesting situation that opened the discussion of who orders the subsoil, because in Colombia, the soil is, or like the topsoil is in like territorial planning by the municipality or the mayor. So the decision taken by the people should be included in the municipality plans to exclude mining in the territorial ordering. But our constitution states that the soil is of the nation. So that the popular consultation opened the question, so who is the nation here? You know, the central government or the municipality or the people deciding they don't want mining. And that opened a huge discussion that went to the court. And in the middle of this momentum or in this situation, then Cajamarca organized a popular consultation that also obtained that 97% of voters against mining. Then that started what we call a popular the popular consultations boom, where other municipalities that were facing extractives in the country held popular consultations, and the government started to limit the democratic participation mechanism. And 9 of them came through, but other 20 were in process until the last government came into power, that was right wing, and they really limited the use or the implementation of the popular consultation. But we were able to make a movement around the country of municipalities, not capital cities, but small municipalities resisting extractives. And like democratically participating and coming up with means to say no to mining. And so all this popular consultation boom has counted with the support of Yes to Life, No to Mining. And that has given visibility to the movement and the process internationally, which was very important. That's why the case of Cajamarca has been an emblematic case for Yes to Life, No to Mining. And especially in Cajamarca, that is a municipality that is known in Colombia as the national pantry, because it's why it has a huge variation of elevation. You know, in the tropics, the climate changes if you move up or down the mountain. And Cajamarca has a territory from like 800 meters over sea level to 4,000 meters over sea level snow peaks. So Cajamarca has a huge possibility of growing food and huge variations of food. And it's a municipality that has mainly small landowners and peasants. So we did a huge campaign after the popular consultation in Cajamarca to help the peasants sell their products directly to the consumers and not through intermediaries who usually stay with the large portion of the economic gain of the product. It's the municipality that grows the most of arracacha in the country. And it's yellow. So we did a campaign around like the real gold of Cajamarca being the arracacha produced by peasants instead of the gold in the subsoil. And we bridged the peasants with restaurants in the cities that started selling, and the peasants started selling the products directly to the restaurants. And yeah, it has been like an interesting example of or reference of how to strengthen a local economy and tackle this discourse so that people say no to mining, they are going to stay poor forever.
Yeah, it's an example of how you can go beyond extractivism and operate outside of the system. And also like an example of true participatory democracy, you know, and I think it's been, as I said, it's been a real inspiration for communities, like especially here in Ireland, because as you know, we have the threat of mining is increasing all the time. 25% of the land in the north of Ireland is concessioned already to mining companies and 28 in the south, you know, so, and just another example of solidarity connected to another Cajamarca. As you know, I used to live in Cajamarca in Peru. And when I was there, connected to communities here in the Sparan Mountains who are resisting mining, and particularly a huge gold mining company by Canadian Dalradian company. So I suppose, yes, the Life Nuna Mining once again there really strengthened community resistance and also shared examples of how we can be resistant and can be living the alternative, you know, that was before, but also new alternatives gained from that sharing across the globe, you know. I just want to also move on then to ask you about your work with Gaia Amazonas, and especially your recent participation in the COP15, which is kind of like what's called like the Nature COP, whereas the other one that took place at the end of the year in Egypt is like the Climate COP. So this COP on biodiversity you were very much involved in, so could you talk about what hope has come from that, what disappointments, like what sellouts, but also kind of what now needs to be done?
It's a very interesting compilation of many things that happened in December in Canada, I think, because I would start by saying that Gaia Amazonas is a Colombian NGO that has been working hand in hand for over 30 years with the indigenous peoples, in the, what we call the Northeast Colombian Amazon. And it's a region that is, well, Colombia, 48% of Colombia is Amazon region. I mean, there's very little awareness of the country almost being half of its territory in the Amazon, even by Colombians. But this area of the Colombian Amazon where Gaia works has no roads and very little contact with the Andean cities and where the most of the non-indigenous population in the country lives. So it's interesting kind of cultural enclave of very well-preserved indigenous cosmovisions that have close relationship with the living system that sustains them and that has a cosmovision that does not separate them from what we call nature. So all their practices and rituals are embedded in the what they call the ecological calendar of the cycles of the other living beings, human and more than human world. They interact, and their cultural principles are very strongly based on complementarity and reciprocity. And that has, there's a completely different paradigm of how to be human in these cultures. And so we have the privilege of working in this region that has the lowest rates of deforestation in the country and perhaps in the whole Amazon region. It's because the land, like Gaia Amazonas, has accompanied them to secure the land tenure rights and the rights to self-governance. And so, based on this, we have built a relationship with Canadian partners, because some years ago, a Canadian company also tried to obtain a mining title in one of the most important sacred sites of the people, the indigenous people that live in this region. And I don't know if you're aware, but more than 70% of the world mining companies call Canada home. So we started working with partners in Canada to explore how to promote or motivate a stronger due diligence by the Canadian government to the Canadian companies and the implications of their actions abroad. So that's why I say it was a confluence of a lot of things. That the COP was taking place in Montreal. We have also been working hand in hand with the indigenous organizations, advocating jointly to specific, like, concrete interests on the new global biodiversity framework from an Amazonian perspective. We have, as Amazon has built its advocacy strategies, in order to be able to position the territorial references of how these territories are managed by indigenous peoples at a national, regional, and international level, how to make these global frameworks more coherent with the Amazonian context because of the importance of the Amazon for the planet as a whole. You know, the Amazon has a very important role in the regulation of vital cycles for life, like the water cycle, the carbon cycle, and the carbon stock, and the regulation of the global climate. So one of our main aims in the new global biodiversity framework, we have been advocating jointly with indigenous organizations from the Amazon since 2 years ago when the negotiations started, were actually three, was for the indigenous territories to be included as a management unit that contributes to the percentage of land surface protected. So what's now called Target 3, that is the 30 by 30 goal, that at least 30% of the terrestrial and marine surface should be under some protective figure in by 2030, used to read through well-connected systems of protected areas and other effective management conservation strategies. And we, from the Amazon jointly, as I was saying, jointly with indigenous organizations from the region, have been advocating for indigenous territories to be included as a management unit that also contributes to biodiversity protection. We have research and data and georeferenced information that proves that the indigenous territories have even less deforestation rates than protected areas. And so it's a much more effective model for, like, you know, conservation with people, like governance systems in place based on their knowledge systems in order to manage these forest areas in a much more effective way that enhances biodiversity and relationships among species than protected areas that sometimes have, you know, some rangers in thousands of hectares that is not so effective than people living and using in a correct and sustainable way and effective and equitable way their territories. So it was achieved. The target now reads something. It includes protected areas, OECMs, and indigenous and traditional territories, which was a long fight, like persuaded by the indigenous representatives in the IIFB, that it's in the Indigenous International Forum for Biodiversity, that is like what's called the Indigenous Caucus, or the like officially recognized indigenous representation in the negotiations. And so we are very pleased with that result, as again, now the challenge is to make that happen, like effectively recognized in the national contexts. Now the countries have to build their MBSATs, where according to the national laws, each country will have to, you know, decide what this implies and how to measure and work hand in hand with indigenous organizations and governments in these territories in order for them to be part of the protection for biodiversity, the national strategies to protect biodiversity.
So would you consider the conference a success then? Or were you hoping for more? And what does this say to you about, I suppose, the future of protecting nature on the planet and, I suppose, like reversing the levels of extinction that we're now seeing?
Well, I think these negotiations have been particularly like an evidence of the idiosyncrasy of humanity in a way that it has taken the world 3 years to agree on 22 targets to protect biodiversity. And it has been very frustrating. You know, it has been very evident how the private sectors have influenced the northern countries that control the funds for biodiversity protection. It has been very evident how some countries have wanted to boycott and slow down the negotiations and lower the ambition And I think that was very evident in the final plenary, where there was a huge discussion around resource mobilization, where the developed countries said they would not open new funds for biodiversity protection. And they were trying to homologate the funds with the climate funds. It was very evident that in the last plenary, all the African countries stood up and say they did not agree, and that they even Congo asked for all the new framework to be put into brackets, the whole thing, after 4 years of negotiations. And I think that was very evident. And like the interventions of the African countries were very explicit in saying, are these the countries that have the funds have gained economical power on behalf have of our natural resources, and now they want us from our own economic resources to fund the protection of the biodiversity we still have, you know? So it was like a very clear evidence of like the dynamics of geopolitics and geopower, you know? And that was very interesting. And I think all the interventions, I think the framework could have ended up being more ambitious, but I think that I value a lot like the discussions that took place. You know, beyond the outcome. The discussions touched points that can leverage the discussions to other places in the future. I mean, if the people involved are clever enough to use as a milestone in how we have, you know, build a relationship with the world we inhabit, and how like the tensions built in between, you know, the different powers in humanity. And regarding the framework, well, the 30 by 30 rule has been one of the most discussed. And it is ambitious, taking into account that in the Aichi targets, the surface target was around 17%. And so there was an increase in ambition in that sense. And it says that the least to be protected is 30 by 30 and 50 by 50 in vision of the framework. In that sense, there's an increase. But beyond the percentage, I think that another interesting thing that happened when thinking strategizing how to protect nature was that scientists had said after like seeing the results of the Aichi targets that even if there were countries that met the Aichi target 11 that stated 70% of the Earth's surface under some protected figure, levels of the biodiversity loss had not changed. So it was like, I think that there's an awareness of the tricky thing about quantitative targets. And that's why there was an intention of qualifying the numerical targets as well, which I think there's an important change in the way we approach this type of things there as well. So for example, the target now establishes that they have to be equitably managed, effectively managed, and well connected. And that is not like a guarantee for anything, but at least in the conception of how we envision, you know, it's not only, it takes it further than creating protected areas on paper. And that, I think that's also a very important reason for why it's interesting that now indigenous territories are included. Now that is effective. That opens the door to effective participation, because before this participation was conceived as having, you know, 30 indigenous people sitting there in the table in the negotiations participating, but that is not effective and real participation. Now, including indigenous territories makes the indigenous governments a key stakeholder in the implementation of the targets. And that opens a door to a new way of understanding participation. So there's interesting things. The indigenous rights are recognized throughout all the targets. The conservation, the rights-based conservation approach increased during the negotiations. So that's also another gain. Now we have to see how the implementation happens. And there's still a lot to go over regarding indicators that will really be how the new framework is implemented.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Marianne. So just to round off then, and you can hear your family behind you. It's lovely to hear the background.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you for your patience.
No, it's lovely to hear the background noise of laughter. So yeah, I suppose just finally, do you have hope like going forward, and what gives you that hope? Not in terms of the conference, but wider in terms of the future of the planet and the future of our communities.
Well, that it's all a matter of how we make all these windows of small changes in the way we approach our relationship with nature and the earth into opportunities, right? Because least at this moment, I feel that there's something to work with. As I was saying, all of the new global biodiversity framework is great because it's only words. It's only words till now. There's some elements that give me optimism in the sense that there's something to work with. It's not a closed, hermetic one way of seeing things. There's kind of, you know, cracks where we can go in and make space wider. And regarding the region and our governments, I think we're in a very interesting opportunity regarding the future of the Amazon. We say that we have 4 years to do what we can to protect the Amazon. It can be very possible that our countries, Brazil and Colombia especially, go back to right-wing governments after these 4 years of left-wing governments. And we have 4 years. The Amazon is almost reaching its tipping point after Bolsonaro's government, that devastating rates of deforestation. If we don't, we have the opportunity of moving away from that tipping point in the next 4 years. And whatever we do in these 4 years is what we are going to be able to do. And I really think that increase of the global temperature is highly influenced by the way the Amazon behaves in the planetary system. You know, like the flying rivers in the Amazon regulate the rain patterns in places as distant as the Great Plains in the US, the Argentinian cereal production areas. And so it has a lot of influence in economy and in food production and food security and in global climate regulation. Like, we really are a little bit like running against the clock, because whatever we do in these 4 years will determine, like, regarding protecting the Amazon is going to determine a little bit of like the fate of humanity in the planet with life as we know it so far.
Yeah, when you mentioned there about the cracks, you know, it reminded me of Leonard Cohen's song, like, there's a crack in everything, that's where the light gets in, you know? So I suppose that's a
hope. Yeah, totally.
Hopeful sentiment to end on. So yeah, thanks very much for joining me, Mariana, and especially since you're on the road. And personally, it's been really lovely to be working with you over the past year, you know, and yes, the life known of mining, and yeah, looking forward to what's to come. So thanks a million.
No, thanks you. I mean, I think that having the chance to speak to people around the world strengthens my sense of optimism. Because I feel that the crack can go a little bit further, and that, I mean, if it's not together, it's not going to happen. You know, if it's not something done collectively, it's not going to be possible.
And thanks to you, our listeners at the ABCs of Green Politics. Thanks also to support from Left Bloc, particularly Trademark and the Creative Workers Cooperative for helping us put this together. Join us for part two of The End of the Road for Optimism? And indeed for the rest of the alphabet. Gur Mayagav.